Hey, hope you're enjoying the Grave Talks. Each and every week, we're now giving you two brand new episodes every Monday and Tuesday. Today and every Wednesday, we're going to flash back to some of our favorite interviews of the past. To listen to our complete archive of episodes, along with commercial-free advanced episodes of the show, months before they're released to the public, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our show. It's only $5. You sign up now at patreon.com/thegravetalks or follow the links at thegravetalks.com. Today on The Grave Talks, a brand new interview with Andrea Perrin about the haunted farmhouse she grew up in that inspired The Conjuring. Andrea Perrin was a young girl when her parents purchased a farmhouse known as the Old Arnold Estate in June of 1970. Andrea writes, "It was a 200-acre plot of land, the big barn and a farmhouse, plenty of space to spread out and explore nature. It was a perfect place to raise a family. According to the owner, though, he failed to disclose a crucial element of the experiences he endured as an occupant. The day we moved in, he told my father, 'Leave the lights on at night.' A rather cryptic message. And thus began an incredible odyssey, a supernatural excursion through dimensions of time and space, as the history of its characters from the ages began to reveal themselves to seven mortals who could not conceive and never anticipated such events transpiring in our lives. For almost a decade, our family lived amongst the dead. There, we came to understand that we are not alone, and there is something beyond mortal existence." Today, we are talking with Andrea Perrin about her experiences and what has happened in her life since the movie that was inspired by her own childhood, The Conjuring, has been released.
It's been miraculous. I can't even begin to tell you how our story has been embraced worldwide. It has touched so many hearts and minds. I've sold hundreds of thousands of books. People write to me all the time and tell me how it changed the way they think and feel about everything. It has been a voluminous mind expansion, wild ride on the roller coaster of life. I have had peaks. I have had valleys. I've had moments. When I first published the first book, knowing that The Conjuring was in the works, but nobody picked up a camera yet or anything like that, my first royalty check was $103, and I wept like a baby. I've destroyed my life. I have destroyed my life. I put everything on hold. I spent all these years working and working and working to write a story that no one's going to read, and I've left myself, you know, behind the eight ball in ways you can't imagine. Depleted all my savings, put everything of myself into this project, and was living on my looks. You know, by the grace of my family and friends, did I keep a roof over my head and food on the table. It was devastating to me. Within a year, everything had changed. The Conjuring changed everything. And even though the movie is certainly not an accurate depiction and representation of the story or my family, in terms of the detail, in the grand strokes, it got it right. Good conquers evil, love conquers fear. The Perrin family endured an extreme haunting that they all survived. Those are the impressions that the audience is left with, and all of that is accurate. Of course, the film was based on the case files of Ed and Lorraine Warren, not on my books. And there's not a single scene in The Conjuring that comes directly from my books. But that being said, if it weren't for The Conjuring, nobody would know about my books. They would be languishing in obscurity, like so many hundreds of thousands of other books are. So I am grateful, but they barely scratched the surface of our story. And so I've spent the last 2 years writing the screenplays for my own story. I got a 3-movie deal for the trilogy, feature films, and that wouldn't have happened if not for The Conjuring. That wouldn't have happened. So I accept what it is. I think it's an artfully made film. I think it's a beautifully made film. I was mortified. I think I mentioned this to you years ago when James Wan was brought on, that I called the executive producer, or he called me, and he's like, "We got James Wan." I'm like, "Oh my God, you just hired the king of slasher porn to make my intimate family story. Oh my God." You know, and he's like, "No, calm down, calm down, Andrea." You know, he's very familiar with the Warrens. He's a, you know, an aficionado of the paranormal. He's very smart. He's a very sensitive man. He's this, he's that, he's the other thing. I said he made Saw, you know, which I never saw, by the way. I knew it by reputation only, and that grossed me out enough. I knew enough about it to know that it's nothing that I would ever put into my brain. You know, impale those images into my mind for eternity. Absolutely not. So basically, I was prejudging him on his reputation in the film industry and what type of work he was doing. And it wasn't until I met James that I realized that I had misjudged him. I thought that he was so kind, so good with the girls that played us. It was as if he had birthed them himself. He cared that much that those kids weren't traumatized, that those kids were always clear from one scene to the next to the next, that this was only a movie. This is a movie. Yes, you are representing real live people, but this is still a movie. You know, because that was our biggest concern, is that, you know, the actors would end up being as traumatized as the actual people that went through it. And so that turned out not to be the case. But I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but when The Conjuring came out, very few of the principals involved with the film wanted to fulfill the back end of the contract, which was that they would promote the film. James Wan went to a couple of different events. Rob, who played my dad, he went to a couple of events. Lily, who played my mom, went to one. Vera Farmiga went to a couple. And then that was it. And they were done. And they needed somebody to go out and promote this film and do, you know, endless interviews and endless public appearances and fly all over the country. And they chose me, and I became the voice of The Conjuring. And so I was walking that very thin line, you know, because I had to be, you know, I live in good faith with myself and with the rest of the world, and I had to be able to be free to say, well, it's not exactly an accurate portrayal, but, you know, these are the differences, but here are the likenesses, and my book, you know. And they gave me the freedom to do that, which I will always be grateful for. And they flew me hither, thither, and yon, and I spent weeks on the telephone or in TV studios shooting one interview after another after another. And I did my part to get the story out into the world, at least some incremental elements of the story out into the world, which is really what The Conjuring is. But now I'm in a position where I will be free to tell the truth. And I really do believe in my heart of hearts that people are ready for this. They are. It's not, you know, the reason why The Conjuring is what it is because when the screenwriters who had read my books devoured them, tried to integrate elements of the true story into the movie, the executive producers and higher ups above them said, no, 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 this will terrify people, this will run people out of the theater. What's the point in making a movie that no one stays to see the end of? And then they still had defectors you know, even when they were doing the preliminary trial runs of it, engaging audience reaction, they still had people that left before the movie was over because of their fear of what might happen to the children that they had grown attached to, knowing that we were real people. That was uniformly the reason on their exit interview why they left the film early, is they were afraid of what might happen and they didn't want to see it. Well, now the world knows that my whole family survived this, and that it was far more than a horror story. It was also a love story. And I think that the world is ready to see the truth, and we've got the very, very best people in place to make this happen, with the acknowledgement and the understanding that I have complete, total oversight of the project, and nothing that is not accurate is going up on a silver screen, period. Now that I've got all my ducks in a row and everything in place, all the right people, I feel very secure that within the next year or two, the truth will begin to emerge. And it will not diminish The Conjuring in any way, but it will be the first time in movie making history that the same story was told from completely opposite perspective.
And that's what I want to talk about today on The Grave Talks. I want to hear your story. I want to hear your experiences. Obviously, there's no way we're going to be able to get through all of them. This is a three-part book series, but let's at least cover a couple of the stories and experiences that took place in that farmhouse. Real stories. Stories that actually occurred, not what Hollywood portrayed in a movie.
The 10 years that I spent living at that house, or the 10 years that that house was in my life, changed everything about who I am. On a fundamental level. The first time that I ever saw a full body apparition happen within, I would say, 3 to 5 minutes of arriving there the day we moved in. Now, we had visited the farm a number of times prior to moving in, and I've asked everybody in the family, and no one remembers seeing anything strange, odd, unusual. Nothing. Zero activity while we were visitors. It wasn't until the day that we moved in that we were so warmly embraced by the netherworld. It changed everybody in my family. My mother and my father are, you know, both now have, you know, they look back on it. My mother looks back on it and says, I learned everything that I needed to know about life, death, and the afterlife by living at the farm. And she has no regrets, even though she was the one that suffered the most. Cindy, who I would say suffered almost as much because of her interactions, some of which were very negative, will look me straight in the eye and say, every time you get on a radio show and you say it was the best decade of your life, I want you to qualify that statement and say that that's not true for every member of your family. I'm like, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. She said, I just want you to know it was the worst decade of my life. And if I could unlive it, I would.
And that's an interesting thing to say, because you all lived under the same roof for the same period of time for the most part, until of course you went off and went away to college, and that part of your life changed. But let's take a look at it from the perspective of everyone's under the same place, they're experiencing for the most part the same things, but there's of course individual experiences that are taking place. What was the dramatic differences between your experiences in the home and her experiences in the home, or the perceptions that both of you had of those experiences?
Cindy was 8 years old when we moved in. When she was 2 months old, she was born with a very severe birth defect. a hemangioma on her face that is difficult to treat when they're small, but this was huge. It was half her face, and she had to have major surgery when she was 2 months old, and they lost her, and they brought her back. But Cindy's been to the other side, and I think that's why she was magnetic to them. She was the one that started hearing the voices first. Her bed was the one that started moving first. There were a lot of firsts with Cindy, and she was terrified. She was absolutely terrified. She had never experienced anything like it. You know, none of us had any kind of paranormal activity in our lives prior to moving to the farm. So I was 4 years older, so, you know, I had a little bit different perspective on it, but I think it was because of her age, and I think it was because she felt inundated, because she was inundated. And yet, April, who was only 5 when we moved in, seemed unaffected by it and made friends with a little boy ghost in the chimney closet and hung out with him when we were at school and was perfectly accepting of them and never really exhibited any fear in the house at all. The only time I ever saw April fearful was when she was worried about something that had just happened to my mother that was inexplicable. So I can't explain why. You know, you can't just chalk it up to age. You can't just chalk it up to experiences and the diversity of experiences. And you can't just chalk it up to different personalities. You know, we're all, even though we're the same family, we're all very, very different. I think that it comes with a level of acceptance. I think that that's where the peace comes from. And Cindy never accepted it. Even though now she does. You know, Cindy has spirit guides, and, you know, whenever something comes up missing or she's feeling anxious about one of her kids or her grandkids, she gets her messages. They're around her all the time. You know, she's very communicative with them. You know, that door was opened. It will never close for any of us. But Cindy's made peace and actually has more experiences, I think, than any of us in the family, and including myself, and that's saying something, because I have experiences almost daily. But last March, we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of my sister's death. Mm-hmm. April passed away, and the first thing she did was go to Cindy. That was the one she went to first. And she had died so suddenly that she didn't realize she was dead. And Cindy had to tell her that she was, because she was confused and she didn't know where she was. And when I was just up in Georgia, Cindy only lives a couple of miles away, and she came over. We were working together. She organizes my brain chronologically for the screenplay. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about that, and I said, you know, Cindy, that April came to you for validation, that she came to you first, even though her greatest and deepest attachment is to Mom. I said, she came to you for a reason, honey, because she knew you would see her. She knew that you would be able to communicate with her. I said, Cindy, if we hadn't had the experiences that we had at that farm as children, can you guarantee me that you would have been able to communicate with April the way that you did hours after her passing? And she said, no, Annie, I can't guarantee that. She said, I guess it wasn't all bad after all.
We hear quite frequently stories of individuals who have come very close to the other side, whether it be through an accident, through maybe a very traumatic birth. But when they do touch the other side, sometimes the sensitivity to the other side gets much stronger. How would you explain, or how do you view why all of you who were in that house, and not everyone having an experience that puts you close to the other side through a medical situation, how do you think it is that everyone walked away from that house being much more sensitive to the other side?
I don't know if it was through exposure or even overexposure mm-hmm. to what is considered the fourth dimension. Mm-hmm. I lecture frequently about this, and I very frequently describe the farm as a portal cleverly disguised as a farmhouse. Mm-hmm. It was a place where we could see into the past, that those in the past could see into the future. It was a conundrum, and yet, I've always espoused that spirituality is science. We just don't understand yet. but there was something going on there that I think profoundly influenced each one of us in different ways. But that over the decades, that has borne out to have purpose and reason. It took my father a very long time to even admit that there was anything going on in the house. 4 decades later, he admits that the reason that he couldn't accept it was because he was scared. He was afraid that he had moved his family into an environment in which he had no control, none. And so his reaction, his personal reaction to that reality was to be angry about it, to be angry in general, to be angry at my mother, to just dismiss, discount, and destroy any notion that the house could be haunted. And it created a rift and a chasm between the two of them, my parents, that never healed. In fact, it wasn't until the morning of my sister's funeral that I saw my mother and father hold each other forever. It's been like forever. That was the beginning of the end of their marriage, living in that house, because he didn't believe or trust what she was telling him. And even when he had his own experiences, he refused to believe what was happening. And it took a while. He was a slow learner. It took a long time. But even now, my father will admit that his faith has deepened. When the Catholic Church turned their backs on us and told my father to take his family and worship elsewhere, he was deeply hurt. He had grown up in the Catholic tradition. He was educated in parochial school. He was an altar boy for his entire youth, and he was destined for the priesthood until he met my mother. And so something that was foundational to him as an individual was suddenly just ripped away because of rumors in town about what was happening up at the Perrin farmhouse. That affected him. Each one of us was affected in very different ways, but I would say that uniformly the benefit to being able to see fourth dimensionally for each one of us, uniformly, we have never felt a complete sense of separation from our loved ones that have passed. Our communication skills and our interaction with those that we love continues to this day. And it was a gift. It was a gift. But my mother nailed it when she said to me one day, I think I was in the midst of Volume 2, tearing my hair out, like, why am I doing this? Oh, my God, why am I doing this? And she came over to me and she said, you were right. this story needed to be told, and this is not the kind of story that anyone should rightfully take to the grave. Mm-hmm. And she's correct about that. If you live to experience something like this and then remain silent about it until you draw your last breath, no one benefits from the knowledge. And none of us, believe me, Tony, when I tell you, none of us care who believes us or who doesn't believe us. This is probably one of the most well-documented hauntings, certainly in American history. And, you know, we have consistently told exactly the same story for the last 45 years. You know, nothing has changed. We don't really, I mean, I didn't write the books to convince anyone of anything. Those that need to read it, those that are drawn to the trilogy, are drawn to it for a reason. And I do believe that our story, not only in print, but what's coming, will be part of the paradigm shift, the raising of human awareness and consciousness around the planet. Not only to know that there is something beyond our mortal existence, but to help end that pervasive sense of loneliness and fear that seems integral to the human condition.
When your family was going through such trying times, such dramatic stress, why do you think it is, retrospectively looking back now, that the church abandoned you, your family, and your father in such an important time?
Because our priest was just another fear-based carbon unit, of which there are many millions on this planet, billions, in fact. He was afraid. He was afraid that his... not only was he afraid about what he was hearing, but he was afraid that his flock that he depended on to fill the, the offering bin would begin to diminish because the parents were being welcomed into the congregation. And I know that for a fact. I know that from the other priest that I went to speak with, who also ministered to the congregation at St. Patrick's Church in Harrisville. This was discussed between them after the fact. And, you know, I was friendly with him, and he was such a good, kind, gentle, older gentleman that I went over to the rectory and I spoke with him about it because my father was devastated. I mean, that was like just ripping away part of his identity, you know, and that was also part of the reason why he's like, you know, ghosts don't exist, because he was raised in that tradition. And, you know, there are many religions that say, you know, you can't, basically, you can't believe in ghosts. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he had been taught, and that's what he had accepted. And so making the leap from accepting, his foundational religious beliefs to accepting that, yes, we did indeed live in a haunted house and that it was really crowded, was a huge leap of faith for him to make. And the only reason that he even began that process was because the church just cut us loose. And I even tried to go back. I was always, you know, very interested in, and I asked a lot of provocative questions. And, you know, I was intellectually precocious about philosophy and religion from an early age. And I tried to go back, and my parents, I didn't even put it in the books, but my parents got a letter from Bishop Gelino, who ran the Archdiocese of Providence, basically saying, we don't want your daughter in CCD classes. Your daughter is not going to be allowed to make her confirmation. Please cease and desist allowing your daughter to come to CCD classes.
It's not exactly the welcoming image I think a lot of us hold of a church that is, or should be there for a family in a trying time, especially with something like this.
Well, it's so incongruous Tony. It's so incongruous. I mean, when you think of the entire ritual of exorcism and, you know, the expelling of demons that are supposedly able to take over our bodies and our consciousness, you know, that's the whole foundation of that is in the Catholic Church. So what? Only exorcists are allowed to believe in spirits? You know, it's absolutely counterintuitive to me.
All these years later, and now that your story has gotten out into the public eye and people talk about it, and it's fairly common knowledge for anyone who has an interest in the paranormal, has the church ever made a statement on their actions at that point in time?
No, it's been pretty much crickets, and that's fine. You know, I mean, at least they didn't boycott it, you know, when the movie came out, like they did with, I believe it was Testament of, I can't remember, it was a movie made about Jesus Christ a number of years ago, and the Catholic Church freaked out, and they were telling all their parishioners, you cannot go see this movie until about 3 weeks after its release, and all of a sudden their churches were full. And the reason their churches were full was because they saw, I think, the Last Testament of Christ. You know, so yeah, faith is a funny thing. And you know, I don't want to offend anybody. Everybody's entitled to believe what they believe. You know, I'm so totally, I think of, all right, just speaking for myself personally, I don't mean to sound scattered, but this is such a difficult issue to talk about without self-editing. I think that religion is crowd control and spirituality is enlightenment. And never the twain shall meet. I really don't see one integrating with the other with any ease, because there are no rules and regulations and doctrine and dogma and, you know, great text that are associated with spirituality. Spirituality is connection to source. Spirituality is developing God consciousness. And my personal belief is that each and every one of us, every living being, is a living, breathing expression of God consciousness, made in the image and likeness of, that it is through us that the Creator sees its own creation. So I find that, some people find that blasphemous. Others think it's the most empowering concept that they've ever heard. But it works for me as an individual. And I have a message to impart to the world. And, you know, you had asked initially when we began talking about, you know, the changes that have occurred in my life since writing these books. I am absolutely no different than I was 10 years ago. I started writing the trilogy in August of 2007, and it was published the day that I began, which was August 7th, 2007, because I wrote it on my calendar. 7 years to the day the third book came out, August 7th, 2014, was the whole trilogy was done. And, you know, I had no control over the timing of that. That was my publisher. Nobody referenced that to when I might have ever said when I started writing these books. I know I never told my publisher that. That was cosmic. That was a cosmic kiss. That was validation, and it was affirmation, and it was pure, unadulterated love. There is so much love wrapped up around this story and what it brings to the world in terms of smoothing out the cognitive dissonance that we seem to feel as a race. Why are we here? What is this for? It asks more questions than it answers, but it's the asking of the questions where the expansion occurs. So, no, I didn't write it for everybody. Yes, you might need a dictionary, to read certain sections of it because I have total complete command of the language, and I'm not going to dumb anything down for anyone. I ask everyone to rise to the occasion and keep a Webster's handy, and when you find the definition for the word that you didn't recognize in the text, you will see that that definition means that that word belongs exactly where it is, and that too is part of the elevation, the vibrational resonating change that is occurring in the brain cells. When you read something like this and you have to absorb it, and you know, I tell people all the time, put it down. When it's overwhelming, just put it down and walk away from it and give yourself a chance to think about this a little bit. You know, I mean, there are chapters in these three books that, you know, bring people to tears and that make them want to take their book and throw it against a wall, which is why I always suggest that I buy the soft bound. It doesn't break the binding. And, you know, I mean, there is it's emotional interaction with the story. And it's not for everyone. I beg people, don't read this unless you're ready. You know, but I really do believe that more and more and more people are ready.
You mentioned earlier that the time you were in that house, the 10 years of growing up that you spent there, that it was 10 of the best years of your life. I would imagine that there must have been many moments, epiphanies, moments of just realization, not only just through growing up and those processes, but from being in the house, where some of those moments were maybe brought on by a situation or an occurrence that happened there in the house. Can you take us there and share some of those moments that happened for you?
Mm-hmm. I can. I can give you two very pointed examples that I reference frequently because of the profundity of them. First and foremost, there's a chapter called Epiphany, and this is my mother's epiphany. My mother was going downhill fast. There was never an exorcism in our house. That did not happen. But there was a seance that went so terribly wrong that it almost cost my mother her life. And yes, Ed and Lorraine Warren are the ones that facilitated that. And they brought a medium in who committed what I consider to be spiritual malpractice and threw open wide the doors to the netherworld, inviting everyone in so that she could determine who the culprit was in the house. I think very rudimentary thinking that resulted in my mother's near fatal injury. But months later, about 3 or 4 months after, my father expelled the Warrens and their entourage from the house, which was not in The Conjuring because it would not have reflected well on the Warrens for obvious reasons. You know, revisionist history, lovely thing that it is. So anyway, about 4 months later, my mother was sleeping an inordinate amount. She was not eating. She was wasting away. She was trying to live on coffee and cigarettes, which I can personally attest to does not work. And one night, about maybe 11 o'clock at night, I had become the de facto mother. I was taking care of my sisters. I was doing the cooking. I was making sure that the kids did their homework and that they were in bed on time. And so all my motherly duties had been done that night. I was sitting on the sofa doing my homework. I guess I was 16 at the time. And my mother came out of her bedroom and walked over to the fireplace, and she looked at me and she said, "I'm hungry." And, you know, my response was, "Glory, hallelujah. You know, I made beef stew tonight. I'll go in the kitchen and fix you some stew." And she's like, "Could you make me a short pot of coffee?" I just looked at her like, "Mom, it's 11 o'clock at night. You want coffee? Really? Okay." You know, just to put food in her. I mean, we were all so very concerned. And we were kids. We didn't know what to do. And so I did what I could do, and I did what was asked of me. And I walked the entire length of that incredibly large house, went into the kitchen, went into the pantry, got a pot of stew out. There were no microwaves invented yet, so I had to warm it up on the stove. So that took several minutes for me to pull together some coffee and some dinner for my mother. I had walked through the house. I had already closed the house down for the night. The dining room was shut down. There were no lights on. There was a light in the front hallway, a small nightlight, and then a night lamp in the kitchen that was on. That was it. The house was dark. My mother threw a log on the fire. It was October, so I was older. I had had my birthday already. And she heard laughter behind her. And she turned around suddenly to look into the dining room that was now fully illuminated with candles and oil lamps on the table. The fireplace that had been sealed shut for more than 100 years when we moved in up the center chimney had been sealed shut. And there was a woman standing there, and she was stirring stew over a blazing fire. She had children that were running around her, and two men sitting at a table that was not our own, a hand-hewn oak table with benches on both sides. None of the furniture was ours. It was theirs. The two men had pewter steins in front of them, which is indicative of the 1700s, because that pewter was outlawed for use in the 1800s. And of the two men sitting there, one of them looked into the parlor and saw my mother standing on the hearthstone, and he smiled, and he nudged the man beside him and pointed her out, and she was the ghost. So she was looking into the past as they were simultaneously looking into the future. And that's when it made sense. The other example that I can give you is when I was 17 years old. I had already gone off to college. I was absolutely miserable. I hated my roommate. Oh, my God, I hated my roommate. She was just pure evil. I don't know what I ever did to deserve her. And so I was miserable, and I called my father. I'm like, oh, Dad, please bring me home for my birthday, because it always falls on Columbus Day weekend. And so I just missed my family and my farm and my spirits, and I missed everything about my life. And I hated college, and I hated Pittsburgh, and I hated my roommate, and I just wanted a few days home with my family. And so he flew me home from Pittsburgh and picked me up at the airport. And when I came to the house, you know, in those 6 weeks that I'd been gone, I guess I must have forgotten the difference between natural cold and supernatural cold. And I was freezing. I couldn't warm up. And Mom had this opulent dinner ready. And I was like, let me just, you know, everybody sat down at the dining room table, and I was just standing in front of the fireplace, just trying to get warm. And I even remember the pants I had on. I had a thick pair of corduroys, brown corduroys on. And I remember my last conscious thought being, I'm standing too close to the fire. Like I was going to singe my clothing. You know, why am I not warm? And then I heard a fork hit a plate. And I looked up, and my father had dropped his fork. And he was staring at me. But he was staring to my right. And I didn't understand what he was looking at. But the whole right side of my body felt like a slab of ice. And I could only move my head. And I turned and I looked into the mirror image reflection of myself as an old woman, wearing clothes from the 1700s. With the leg of mutton sleeves and the pearl buttons, and my hair, my big thick hair had gone gray and was all up in a bun, and I was looking into my own eyes. And I'll tell you, I'll never, for the whole rest of my, not for a moment, will I ever forget that sensation, because she smiled at me. She knew me. And nobody in my family saw her face. They could only see her torso. They could see her body to the floor. They could see the dress, but they didn't see her face. She was looking directly at me. And when I turned and looked directly at her, I realized why we had that house. That even though there was no connection in historical records to all, anybody in our family having anything to do with anybody that had ever owned that house. There was a familial connection that is absolutely undeniable, and it is hands down the best evidence I've ever seen, and what I consider to be empirical evidence for the argument for reincarnation.
It was almost you connecting with the former you.
Yep, and the day we moved out, my mother said, I told my mother the day we moved out, I told her what I saw that day several years before. And she just patted me on the hand and she said, oh, honey, I always knew we bought this house for you.
Let's talk a little bit about revisionist history and when your father made the decision to kick the Warrens out of the home after the botched seance that almost killed your mother. What was the reasoning? What was his mindset at that moment to get those people out of the house?
So that he wouldn't kill them. He was that angry. I've never seen him so angry. As far as he was concerned, he didn't, when he threw them out of the house, he didn't yet know if my mother had even survived what had happened to her. It took him quite a while. He checked all of her vital signs. She was knocked unconscious. The Warrens did not want us to call the police. They did not want us to call for an ambulance. We were instructed by them not to call the authorities. And my father was down on his hands and knees over my mother, who was laying in the middle of the parlor floor. You know, everyone in that house heard her skull hit that floor. She had been tossed more than 20 feet from the middle of our dining room into the parlor in a captain's chair, in a chair that probably weighed 30 or 40 pounds, and just picked up and tossed in a split second. And everybody in that house thought they had just watched her die. And my father was so busy trying to bring her back that he didn't even call for help. But he threw the Warrens out of the house because it was that, or he had already just punched Ed Warren in the face and bloodied his nose and broke his nose and took him to the floor, a man twice his size. So it was going to get really ugly if we didn't get them out of there.
Did any of the documentation that was attempting to be done when that horrific event occur survive? Any of the audio, any of the video, did anything make it out the door?
No, none of it did. There was no audio, and the video cameras that had been set up in the basement had been shattered when the cinematographers went back downstairs to get their state-of-the-art equipment. It was in pieces all over the cellar, and both of those men came upstairs sobbing with what little they were able to. There was nothing salvageable, but, you know, they grabbed what they could. You know, their tripods and stuff like that. It looked like something had just picked up the tripod with the camera on it, folded the legs, and used that tripod as a baseball bat, and taken those cameras and slammed them into solid granite walls. And there was no one in the basement when that happened. The cellar was vacant of human beings when that happened. And, you know, it seems to me if there was any film footage, any audio or video that had actually been salvaged from that night, that would have made its way out into the public sector sometime around The Conjuring. I don't think that it exists.
After all that happened, was there ever any communication, again, at that period in time, between your family and the Warrens?
The Warrens came back about 3-4 months later, right around Halloween of that year. So it was approximately 2 years after they had originally shown up at our door. My mother had no idea who they were when they came to the door. So that was another thing that the movie got wrong, because it intimated that she went and sought them out. She had no idea who this couple was, but it was a cold night and she invited them in to warm up. The only other time that we had any physical contact with them was just about 3 months after that incident, and they came to the house They waited until they saw that my father's car was not there. Obviously, they did not want an altercation with him. And my mother opened the kitchen door and spoke with them through the screen. And basically, they said they wanted to come and see if she was all right, because they left that house that night not knowing what her condition was. And my mother assured them that she was fine, but she did not invite them across our threshold ever again. And they turned and they left and they went back to Connecticut. Then in 1980, Mrs. Warren called my mother about 3 months after we moved to Georgia, sold the farm and moved to another home. And she wanted to offer my family a boatload of money to tell our story. And she had a ghostwriter with her, which I love that phrase, with her, named Gerald Brittle, who has since sued and lost a claim against Warner Brothers for actually having all the rights to a story that he has zero rights to. And she had him with her on the other end of the phone, and I was home with my mother when the phone call came. And Mrs. Warren wanted to tell our story in print and on screen, and my mother declined, and Mrs. Warren said, "You have to at least discuss this with your husband. This is too much money to just say no to." And so my mother agreed that she would discuss it with my father that night. When he came home, he gathered all of us up, and we went on an excursion into town to have dinner. And my mother decided to stay home alone. And that night, when she went down to throw a load of laundry into the washing machine in the cellar of our new house, she was attacked, physically attacked. And the next day, when Mrs. Warren called her back, she said, "The answer is no, and please don't ever contact us again." So, you know, Cindy says that attack, even though it really hurt my mother physically, was the best thing that ever happened to her. Because she felt like it stopped everything. It not only stopped any further discourse with the Warrens, but it also prompted my mother to beckon the power of her own Cherokee ancestors to lift this burden from her. And it worked. And for all these years, she's been free of it.
How about later in time, once several pages had been turned on the chapter of your family's life in that home, and many years later when The Conjuring came out, was there any interaction at that point with the Warrens and any perspective given on what happened there or what their viewpoint was on what happened there?
Yes, actually. Mrs. Warren and I was invited out. I brought my sister Cindy with me, and Lorraine brought Tony, her son-in-law, with her, and the four of us went out in March of 2013. We were graciously invited to a private screening of The Conjuring 3 months before its release. And Warner Brothers put us up in a beautiful hotel in West Hollywood, and they did a whole series of interviews with myself and my sister and did all the background on our family story. Consequently, they were doing the same thing with Lorraine. You know, it was really, it behooved them to have us out there, not only to get our initial visceral response to The Conjuring and with their fingers crossed that it would be good, but also so that they could get all of their background information ready to put out in the packages that go with the films. So it served a dual purpose. And when I came out of the elevator, Cindy and I came out of one elevator, and the elevator right next to it opened simultaneously, and there was Lorraine Warren, and neither of us had seen her in 40 years. And she opened her arms, and we just embraced. I don't think they ever tried to do anything to hurt us deliberately. My father thinks that they, you know, were trying to exploit us for their own gain, and there's an argument to be made for that. But I looked these people in the eyes. You know, when I was a teenager, when you're most open and you're also most watchful. And, you know, I never felt that they wanted, they never asked my parents for a dime. They made that trip from Connecticut 4 or 5 times in terms of conducting an investigation of the property. And yes, they did talk out of school about things that happened at our house that started drawing people to the house. They were dropping our name. They were talking about Harrisville. It was easy enough for anybody that was interested to come into town and go to the general store and find out where the house was. So, you know, they made some mistakes. They did. Lorraine even admitted to me that they were in over their heads from the inception, and that her Ed's last request of her prior to his death was to make sure that the Perrin family story got told, because he always insisted verbally and in print that it was, and these are his words, of all the investigations they conducted over 40 years as paranormal investigators, they described our haunting as the most intense, disturbing, and significant of all the investigations that they ever conducted, and that they did not have my parents' permission to share it after we left the house was the bane of their existence. You know, it really was, because they felt like they were robbing people of this incredible story. And then when the story got told, it wasn't accurate. So it's now incumbent upon me. And, you know, had it been accurate, had I walked away from it thinking, oh, well, they nailed that, I would never have written these screenplays. You know, so everything happens for a reason. It does.
Andrea, your story has always been extremely intriguing to me, and I'm excited to hear about the screenplay and your version of the events, the real version of the events coming to the screen. What is the timetable looking like on that as that project continues to be underway for you?
I think that we will begin shooting. I'm finishing up the second one, and then I've got to bang out the third. Oh, yeah, like in copious amounts of work. If I thought writing the trilogy was tough, taking the trilogy and extrapolating what's important chronologically to share with the world, you know, and then having to leave the rest behind, that slash and burn thing is the most, yeah, it really is. It's the most challenging thing I've ever had to do. But it's also been incredibly rewarding. You know, I've made that transformation from author to screenwriter now. And everybody that's read the screenplay, the first screenplay, they're losing their minds. They're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, when can we start? I'm like, just hold your horses and let me finish the second one, and then we can start storyboarding. And then while you're storyboarding and getting all of that done, I'll finish the third one. And we have to follow my timeline here, because nobody can do this for me. And it has to unfold naturally the way it's supposed to. And I'm not in charge of that. I just get up and do my work every day. So I think that I'm hopeful that we can begin shooting by the end of this year. The plan is to shoot the three films back to back and to use two or three sets of children, because these three films have to express the length of time that we lived at the farm. And I looked a whole lot different at 21 than I did at 12. You know, we moved in, April was 5 and she was 15 when we moved out. We grew up there. So we have to do this in such a way that, we cover that decade, but, you know, keep all the principal actors. We already have some of the roles cast, and the principal roles, there are some really top actors in the industry that are biting on this, that want a piece of this. One, I cannot say his name, that wants to play my father, because he would have a stroke if I said it, but an A-lister that wants to play my father for the three. And, you know, and I give all the credit to that, not because I know all these people individually, I don't, but my producer is the head of the Producers Guild of America. There's no one he doesn't know. So he's putting this out very selectively, you know, it will all fall together. It will all come together. I'm hoping that we start filming this year, finish next year, and start releasing the films by the middle to the end of 2019 through 2020.
Andrea, I'm excited to hear that, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing those once they come out. I hope you'll come back on the show as those events occur to keep us updated, and so we can talk almost movie by movie about what to expect and to hear some insight into your life experiences.
Well, you know, you are one of the most professional people in the business, and I thoroughly recall and thoroughly enjoyed my first interview with you, and this just, you know, carried on the tradition. Let me just say publicly here and now, I am at your disposal whenever you want to have a chat with me. You just let me know.
Andrea, thank you so much for those kind words. Andrea's book is House of Darkness, House of Light. It's a trilogy series of books. You can find out more about that at House of Darkness, House of Light. com. And of course, we'll keep people updated on the program about the movie progress as it continues. Thank you for talking with us today, Andrea. And thank you for listening to today's episode of The Grave Talks. If you like our program, do us a huge favor and press subscribe on whatever platform it is you are listening to us. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you download podcasts on. That is what helps other folks know that we exist. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi.